Talked after breakfast this morning and came to the conclusion that there was enough similarity in what we both wanted to do that you're stuck with the two of us in one session. Actually not. Holden is about conversation, right. And so maybe we can have a conversation with each other and then all of us can. Erling wanted to talk about Billy Graham, and my series was at the point this morning where I'm ready to talk about the church in the context of Western liberal democracy. And it seems to me that Graham represents an important case study almost in the dilemmas that confront us in Western liberal Western democracy. So what we're going to do this morning is let me spend the first few minutes sketching out what the situation is, the church in liberal Western democracy, and obviously liberal is not a dirty word in this context, it's a descriptive word, and then Erling will do Billy Graham as a case study, and then we'll all be in on it, so I'm excited. Anything you want to add to that introduction?
Go for it.
All right, here we are. My series has been called The Lessons of Barman, and for those of you who are new to the village, just a word. Barman in 1934 was a dramatic example of the church in a prophetic and costly opposition to Nazism, to Hitler, and to Deutsches Christentum. I quoted Hermann Sasse, that most Lutheran of Lutherans, who said, "The issue is Germanism or Christianity." And I have resisted drawing any parallels because there aren't any easy ones. Instead, I think there are some disturbing questions. And I have tried to get at the implications of Barman, the lessons of Barman, by trying to look at ways for the church to be, ways for the church to understand itself in society. I looked at three ways so far. First, the established church. That's where the church is given by the government or assigned by the government the responsibility for the religious dimension of society. The established church was the context for the events of Barman. Secondly, the church in opposition. The prophetic martyr church. Barman was the example of that, and it may be that in a sense only an established church can finally be forced into this kind of a role. And then yesterday I talked about the excluded church, or the church under communism, where it has no role officially in the shaping of its society at all. Communism doesn't want it to have a role. Instead, the East German churches are now moving from opposition, which they had thought was the lesson of Barman, to a different kind of role. They're saying, okay, we're excluded from public life. What do? We are critics. Now, a critic is not only one who criticizes, who says what's wrong. A critic is also one who applauds, who says great performance. And so the church is doing both of those things under communism. It is at the same time saying, this is what we applaud, this is what we approve of, and on the other hand saying, we're going to hold you, communist government, accountable on your terms for living out your charter. We're not going to tell you what your charter is, but you tell us, and then we'll hold you responsible. That's the role of the church in East Germany. Now, we are none of the above in America. We are not established. We are certainly not in militant, Barman-like opposition to our government. And we are not excluded from the shaping of public life. So we have another set of questions that we have to deal with. And I want to get at those now in maybe 10, 11 minutes or so. America is a liberal democracy. You could quibble and call us a republic, but the differences are not all that great. And that notion is a product of the Enlightenment. I want to make that as the first point. Democracy is not innate. It's not the normal way people have to be. I mean, whole societies, whole eons of world history, people thought it was totally normal not to be part of a democratic society at all. Luther did not found democracy. He was a totalitarian. That was the way God ordained things. And everybody said, yes, that's the way it's supposed to be. Democracy, and if you look on a dollar bill, you will find this on the Great Seal of the United States. They knew they were doing something brand new when they adopted as a part of the Great Seal the phrase Novus Ordo Seclum, a new order of the ages, is coming into being here. So democracy is not innate, it is instead a historical product. It is a product of the Enlightenment of the 18th century. Jesse Helms and all the people who tell the American story as if we were founded on Christian principles simply do not know historically what they were talking about. The framers of the Declaration of Independence and of the Constitution of the United States were in the forefront of Enlightenment thinking. Jefferson, Franklin, Adams, all the Adamses, however many there were, Thomas Paine, some of them did not believe in God at all. Some of them believed in a God that was so vague, Franklin, for example, that you couldn't tell what it was. Jefferson was probably a Kantian moralist. None of them were recognizably Christian. None of them. I mean, and I'm not calling them any dirty name by that. I'm simply trying to be historical. The Enlightenment of the 18th century was a series of interactive revolutions, scientific, philosophical, religious, economic, social, and political, which ushered in the modern world. Four major themes that I want to lift out. And by the way, pervading all of this was the complete absence of a doctrine of sin and a doctrine of redemption. They didn't. That's the one thing you see that makes them all unchristian or non-Christian. Point is, we've come to associate Christianity with being nice, and so to call somebody non-Christian is to say they weren't nice. They were very nice. They were fine people. They just didn't believe in sin and redemption. What did they believe in? Four things. One, critical reason and human autonomy is the source to truth and knowledge. Truth and knowledge are not imposed on us by religious authorities or political authorities. They are discovered in conversation. Democracy for these people did not mean an opinion poll, sitting in front of your television set and pushing a button and then they say, oh, 44% agree and 22% don't. It's not democracy. Jefferson meant it to be a conclave in which, through argument, and the bringing to bear of the insights of all, the truth would finally emerge. That's how it was supposed to happen. So the Senate and the Congress were to be places of debate. The senator and the congressman were not primarily elected to represent the opinions of their constituency, but simply because people said, oh, these are going to be the best debaters from our area. And so they were to go to Washington and to debate, or to wherever and debate, and that's how the truth would come. That was also how the truth was to be sought in every area of life. So that's the first principle. Critical, experimental, dialogical reason is the way you find things out. In the Middle Ages, if you wanted to know what to do, you went to the Bible. If you wanted to know how to cure a stomach ache, you went to the Bible. It says, take a little wine. In the 18th century, you would do an anatomy study and some experimenting, and maybe later on you'd come up with a conclusion. Totally different way, the modern way. Secondly, God gave us an orderly world and we can discover its laws. God was affirmed, but he was affirmed as basically an absentee deity. God was irrelevant to the functioning of the world. So let us not imagine that just because they said we are endowed by our Creator and all that kind of stuff, that they believed in God. They did, but in a God who was totally irrelevant to the day-to-day conduct of life. Nature was there for us to learn about and to master. Third, history is progress. It's not automatic progress, but it is basically progressive. It was the Enlightenment that gave us the notion of ancient, medieval, and modern world. Medieval was bad. I mean, and we still talk that way. Oh, don't be so medieval, we say, you know. What we mean by that is old-fashioned, which is bad. The latest is the best. That was Enlightenment. And hence, optimism about the future, provided we are in control. That's what gives America, in a sense, its unique cast. You see this every time you go to Europe. These are people whose lives are shaped by the past. We are a people whose lives are dominated by the future. Let us rise up, tear down, and build, is the way we work. You know, if it lasts 20 years, fine. Then tear it down and build over again. Because later is better. Better bathrooms, better flush toilets, better everything, better supermarkets. That's progress. And the fourth idea is the most important for religion, tolerance and optimism. I mean, tolerance and pluralism. The Enlightenment arose in large measure out of disgust with the religious wars, with people killing each other in the name of dogma. What was the quip from 1066 and all that? The Druids invented the wheelbarrow and called it agriculture. They burned each other alive and called it religion. The people of the Enlightenment said, enough already, we're finished with all that, no more religious wars. And how do you do that? You do away with the established church. Thomas Jefferson said two things were important to go on his tombstone. It wasn't the Declaration of Independence, it wasn't being President of the United States, and it wasn't the Louisiana Purchase. It was the founding of the University of Virginia and the disestablishment of the Episcopal Church. Think about that. Those were the, when his life is over, he said, that's what's important. Disestablishment of the church. People railed against Jefferson as godless. Today he's canonized by the moral majority. Then they knew he was godless. He was in favor of disestablishment. Madison, James Madison, fourth president of the United States, said, let the sects multiply, it will diminish their influence. See, they didn't want religion to have influence. They would have, to a man, voted against Jesse Helms and all the provisions all the pious provisions of the Reagan administration. That's exactly what they did not want. They said, let's have denominations, lots of them, none of them therefore will run the show. That was the idea, and they got it. They assigned a role to the church. The church is no longer a source of knowledge. Watch on television. When somebody wants to tell you they really know something, they put on a white hospital or laboratory coat. They don't put on a cassock anymore. You don't go to church to find knowledge. You go to church for emotional comfort and for socially correct moral instruction. But you don't go for knowledge. In fact, clergymen are not regarded as the sources of knowledge. See? They are regarded instead as comforters, consolers, handholders, moral examples, a lot of things, but not a source of knowledge. Secondly, the church is no longer established, rather, denominations arise who are voluntary, diverse, and relative. The meaning of denomination is you don't make an ultimate claim. You don't say, we've got the last word. It's your thing. The denomination is a Cosa Nostra, our thing. You know, whatever your thing is, that's your denomination. Third, the denomination and religion are called on for public rhetoric of a general sort. Eisenhower said it. America is built on firmly felt religious principles, and I don't care what they are. See, that's it, exactly, right? Firmly felt religious principles, and I don't care what they are. So there's public rhetoric of a general sort, you see, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, but not to shape public policy. Fourth, religion deals basically with private and familial aspects of life. So you don't talk about it. In the same way that you don't talk about your income, your sex life, your divorces, none of that. I mean, that's just, you don't talk about it. So you don't talk about your religion either. It's deeply felt. Everybody knows you got it. but you don't talk about it because it's private and familial. That's the role. Now that gives the church problems and possibilities. On the one hand, the American climate has been incredibly hospitable for the church. In every other Western culture, the church has declined, even if it's been established. What church don't you go to? The Lutheran or the Anglican? That's what you find out in Scandinavia or in England. But in America, the climate has been incredibly hospitable. I mean, we, in 1945, 42%, about 60 million people in America belonged to churches. By 1975, the numerical figure had more than doubled, 140 million, and the percentage was up to 69. And it's incredible. And we go, 42% of us are in church Sunday morning. I mean, you're going to hear alarming statistics about how many people go to professional football games. Not as many, by a long shot, are at professional football stadiums on Sunday afternoon as are in churches on Sunday morning. So church has been hospitable. What kind of a role? I have tried to coin the term conspirator, and I want to use it in two meanings. The Latin conspirare means to breathe together, to combine for a purpose. And so we share many values with the Enlightenment. That's part of the reason why the church has been hospitable, America has been hospitable to the church. But conspirator also means belonging to an organization which plots against those in power. And that says we do not share all the values of the Enlightenment. Let me just go over them briefly again. What does the church do with critical reason and human autonomy when it's also got revelation? See? Because we believe both. It's how to find our way between fundamentalism on the one hand, which is only revelation, or liberal secularism, which has no revelation. See, we're somewhere in between there. We want to say yes to critical reason, but at the same time, we also believe there is such thing as revelation. Or, we are grateful for the scientific study of nature. I definitely do not want to go back to the medicine practiced in Luther's time, where the only solution was to bleed you. I am darn grateful to have had my hemorrhoidectomy. It works. I am not. My student sent me a card saying, you've just got to stop asking your doctor to kiss it and make it well. Is that on tape?
It's on tape.
My colleague sent me a card saying it's been discovered in a recent survey that half the professors at Lutheran seminaries have hemorrhoids and the other half are perfect asses. If your surgeon is successful, they said, you may have new status. Well, he was, and I do. I'm glad for that, okay. But at the same time, we are painfully aware of the fact that scientism cannot have the last word, and suddenly our so-called mastery of the world has begun to confront us with a bunch of questions that are of value questions for which science no longer has the answer. How is God involved in nature without being absent from it? That's the dilemma that we confront, you see. So on the one hand, we want to say yes, on the other hand, no. Thirdly, history, progress, and optimism. Christianity says we have hope, not optimism. And that's very hard to work at, because now we're confronted with some place between Robert Schuller and Hal Lindsey, you see. What does it mean that Christ is our hope, but we're not all going to be raptured before the Armageddon? That's the question. That's the dilemma that confronts us. How do you distinguish hope from optimism? Reagan is an optimist. I'm a hoper. See, we are operating in two different ball games. Finally, tolerance. Of course I'm for it. Religion has thrived under it. Does it mean then that all absolute claims have to be given up? Or if we make absolute claims, are we going to end up with a new Inquisition, with witch burning and some form of religious McCarthyism? The cross, Christians say, is the way we can make an absolute claim which allows us, not only permits, calls on us, to be persuasive rather than authoritarian. The dilemma for the church is that our culture asks us to bless it, to provide chaplains for the military, to put flags in our churches, to have the oath of allegiance in our schools and let our kids learn it, to say prayers at Rotary clubs and to go to prayer breakfasts, to have chaplains at national conventions and so on, to bless its values, to say yes to it. But we can only do so very equivocally. We can't say an unqualified yes to our culture. And that's what our culture basically doesn't really understand about us. Martin Marty, in one of his books, calls on us to make temporary strategic alliances. How do we do that? And as Lutheran Christians, I'm assuming most of us are that here, we have different functions in different places. Lutherans in Utah are in a totally different cultural situation than Lutherans in North Dakota. In North Dakota, they run the place. In Utah, they're lucky to be allowed to live there. You know, I mean, so that's the problem that we face. And Graham is a very interesting case study in dealing with it.
That's a tough act to follow, right?
I want to. You mean you've not had a hemorrhoidectomy yet? I recommend it, Erling.
Remember when you were little kids and all of a sudden you were playing with Chuck Aker or somebody and you finally said, I just think I'm going to pick up my toys and go home. You know? No, seriously, when we talked about this, I was kind of curious as to what we would be talking about. And we sort of remembered in the old Carol Hinderly fashion about hum me a few bars and we'll wing it. And that's what we're doing today, and I think that's fun. And Walt set up things so masterfully here that it's easy for me to take it from this point on, and I appreciate that very much. Because we should start with Billy Graham and saying that he's the best known and probably the most respected Protestant clergyman in all of world history. I think I can state that without any fear of contradiction. He's certainly the best known. Yes, he has a great advantage over Dwight Moody or Charles Finney or Jonathan Edwards or anybody else because of television and because of world global travel and the jets and all the rest of these things. But nevertheless, he is the best known and I think probably the most respected clergyman or Protestant clergy that we have in the world. And obviously the popes, as they come and go, would be from the Catholic perspective. And hence, his credentials are in order. I mean, we have to take Billy Graham seriously. He's trying right now to retire rather gradually from the responsibilities which he's had, but still nobody has come to take his place. When I did this 2 weeks ago, people asked who was going to replace him, and right now it isn't immediately clear. But since you mentioned some of my friends on the right, Jerry Falwell is trying very hard to become Mr. Conservative Protestant Clergyman in this country, going on the Phil Donahue shows and all the rest of these things, writing books about peace of mind, for goodness sake. They're ghost books like anybody else, but he's trying very hard, and he can't quite get there because of the whole business with fundamentalism and the rest of these things. But Graham is interesting because Graham knows the Enlightenment heritage that Walt laid out so admirably. I wish I could do that in my old History 49. I think the students would finally get it if we had you lecturing to them on that one. And do I have anybody here left over from... Where's Paul or Mark or... All right, anyway, see, I have a little refresher on that. But anyway, Graham knows the Enlightenment heritage. Progress, optimism, scientific reasoning, all the rest of these things. He knows the what we call the Madisonian pluralistic thing. Should I just elaborate a little bit on James Madison? He was a communicant Episcopalian. That I have to say because he's one of my particular favorite presidents because he was a historian, among other things. And I've only had a couple of historians in the White House, and I'm glad when anyone shows up. Okay. Anyway, Madison was arguing the question, you know, because the only background he had was the European experience where they had nothing but establishment and the 30 Years' War and all the rest of these things. And he said if there was one church in charge, there would be total tyranny. If there were two churches competing with each other, they'd be at each other's throats all the time, and you'd have nothing but bloodshed and warfare, like you had either with Lutherans and Calvinists or Lutherans and Catholics or whatever in what we now call Germany. But if you have all of them, that's the point that he was quoting Voltaire, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Everybody would live in peace and harmony with one another. Okay. Graham knows that. Graham understands pluralism, but he would like very much to have something close to what we would call a Christian America. His background, his training, his values, all the rest of these things lead him to that position. And also, I think his theology does, not only because of his values growing up. 1917 he was born, if somebody wants to date him. But his values of hard work, thrift, the old Protestant work ethic, and although it has to be said about the Protestant work ethic, there's a famous Jewish intellectual named Irving Kristol in New York, and he was studying the so-called Protestant work ethic, and he said it sounds like the Jewish work ethic as far as he's concerned. So we have to be careful with that term. But anyway, Graham was, Graham grew up with the old traditional ideas of hard work and thrift, and which will be rewarded and all that. And Graham also believes in instant conversion, kind of approach to Christianity. There's a famous definition, or differentiation, I should say, in what we call the nature-nurture argument. This is something which I think is a helpful one. The nurture argument is pretty much the mainline or the high sacramental church position, where the Catholic, the Episcopalian, Anglican, Lutheran one, wherein if you participate actively in the sacramental life of the church and do so in a conscientious fashion, you grow, you're nurtured, you're fed, whatever term you want to use here, by the church, and you grow. And that's why we can have, one reason we can have infant baptism, is that you don't have to make the decision for yourself at an infant at a time, at an early time in your life, but it's all the the other things with infant baptism that go with this. Graham comes from the what we call the adult believers, or the adult baptism school, in which a person has to be brought to a moment of decision, the hour of decision, in fact, is what, you remember, he calls his radio program. And then, on the basis of their own judgments, on the basis of their own volition, they make the choice. Okay. And then, there, in a very real sense, their human nature is changed. In fact, in the book, How to Be Born Again, about 3 years ago, he said, we take on a new nature. And he, in a sense, moves away then from the Lutheran position, daily drown the old Adam. You remember that from your catechism class, and we're just as much a sinner the day we die as the day, we were baptized. And the differences between the nature and the nurture kind of argument. Okay, if you go for the nature argument, or that you can change your human nature, then you can believe in, in the theological term here is sanctification. That you can grow in holiness. You can make not the kind of progress that Walt was talking about here, but you can make significant progress in your own personal life. Okay. And will become like, the old metaphor, person in a rowboat taking a big rock out into the middle of the lake, dropping it, and you get the ripple effect. Once you have a few conversions, as you will in an instant revival like we had in the Great Awakening, these will ripple out, and finally everybody will hopefully be brought into one major big sort of, born again kind of experience. And once that's happened, then you're well on the way towards sanctification. Okay. And you don't have to wrestle with the devil and all his works and all his ways every day. You do, but it isn't anywhere near as serious a battle as had been the case before. So what Graham wanted to do, and is sort of modified on this, and to come to the point that Walt's talking about here, is to find ways for the born again to become the chief force, the leaven, whatever you want to call it, to help bring America to a position where we wouldn't have a state church, we wouldn't have an established church, but we would have a totally Christianized, in that particular sense of the word, kind of society. And you'll notice the way in which he works on this. He has to face the question here, to what extent then does the born again Christian become a dissenter or a rebel or a critic of his own kind of society? To what extent does he accept the values of the society in which he's born? And he doesn't get into the, and Graham avoids something here to make this maybe a little clearer. I mean, Graham avoids participation or membership, whatever you want to call it, in what we call the peace churches. Mennonite, Hutterite, Amish, all these other kind of churches who see themselves as set apart, as called apart, to be a witness themselves and simply not conform to the work. And in their clothes, their dress, the way they share and use property, their attitude towards government, towards conscientious objection, all these different things. Graham doesn't go into the what we call the peace church tradition. He stays in the born-again kind of tradition. So how then can, Graham's question is, how then, given the fact that you accept membership in the American body politic, and therefore you have to accept pluralism, which means that you have to give equal rights and equal opportunities for people who are non-Christian to have their particular way of expressing themselves religiously. How can you do that and still have something like a sanctified or Christianized kind of society? That's the question he's faced. At first he thought, I don't want to go into the history of this, but at first he thought when his revival career really got started in 1949 in Los Angeles, where it took off, and Hearst put him on the front page of all the Hearst papers in the country. Henry Luce, who was at that time editor publisher of Life, himself a staunch Christian. He was an old PK, wasn't he, from a China kid. His father had been a missionary China. Luce picked up on this bright young evangelist he thought would be useful in the Cold War against the Russians, because Graham was talking about the spiritual battle more than the economic struggle and everything. Luce gave him a great deal of publicity, and Graham received a great deal of attention wherever he went, and became so convinced of what he was doing that in 1957 he tried his biggest move of all. He went in and he said he was going to save New York, and if he could save New York, he could save all of America. He was using the old model of Jonathan Edwards and the other Great Awakening preachers of the 1730s and 40s, thinking that everybody in this sort of ripple effect could be saved. And that therefore you weren't, and he certainly wasn't violating any kind of pluralistic values in this country, but he thought it could be done. And what happened, obviously, was it bombed. Somebody who was a wonderful quip from a historian, people listened to Billy Graham talk about original sin, and they were charmed. I think that was the term that was used. Graham was one more media event in New York City. He was interviewed by Steve Allen and all the rest of the talk shows and everything else. And isn't this quaint? Isn't this nostalgic? Here's an old-fashioned Bible. My father-in-law called them Bible thumpers. And they hadn't seen anybody like this for a while, and he was one more good act. He was co-opted by the secular society, as John Schramm was always calling it, Babylon upon the Hudson, how he would refer to New York City. And Graham then went in a different direction. The revival of the 50s faded really after that, and then decided if you're going to have sort of a sanctified, religious, Christianized America, you would work through individuals, obviously, rather than trying to save whole collectivities like New York City or New York or America or whatever else, and also work through specific social institutions. And here's where he shows his sharpest break, I think, with what's called the Peace Church people or with the mainline people. He believed that the Christians could have a tremendous degree of influence on two or three areas of social participation in this country. For instance, one would be private property. He has no quarrel at all with private property, even to this day. He always argues that there's never in the Bible is a rich man as such condemned for being rich. He has no quarrel with the idea that you deserve what you earn. If you watch carefully, his role models are successful business people, from capitalist kind of society, and makes a strong case for that. He has no quarrel with that. In contrast, let's say, to the Peace Church people, who sharply differentiate from that. So he's accepted that. He's accepted, I suppose you could call it, the private property value in this country as necessary and as a good thing, and goes from that. The second thing is patriotism. Again, in sharp contrast to the Peace Church people, he has changed on this for a while, but as Walt was talking about before, he was, until Watergate, he was our unofficial chaplain in the White House. He first got started in 1949 after the big publicity boost he got from Hearst and Luce. He was invited to the White House, made one very interesting tactical mistake. Truman was an old-fashioned Southern Baptist too, and Graham and a couple of others, Grady Wilson and some of his friends, and Cliff Barrows, he didn't have his trombone with him that day, but I kind of miss old Cliff Barrows' trombones. I watch all the Graham revivals, and I wish he had it when he was leading the Union Choir, and you see the organist once in a while here wave a hand, and I kind of wish we could have old Cliff wave the old trombone again, but some things go the way of what television want and don't want in there, the leaders want and don't want. He came, and there was a lot of attention. Here was this snappy young dresser in the White House Rose Garden, and in front of all the reporters, Graham and two or three other of his people knelt and prayed for Harry Truman. Well, you know what hit the fan. Since we're talking about that area. And Graham realized that just wasn't, that this wasn't going to get anywhere. You just don't do those things. Truman was not happy about being prayed for. But he came and back and forth. He became very well accepted by Eisenhower. Kennedy had him in, although I don't suppose he sat around for a mass. from time to time. And then came the difficulty because Nixon used him, and he didn't realize he was being used. There were times, I've got pictures where the two, Nixon and Pat and Ruth and Billy were seen coming together into a mass rally at the University of Tennessee, the Coliseum. And there were prayers for the country and prayers for our leaders and all the rest. And then suddenly Watergate came. And what was fascinating about Graham was his first reaction to the tapes was his shock over the vocabulary, the deleted expletives. That he found, because in all his years with Nixon, he had never heard those particular kinds of terms, which we almost heard over here, a little while ago. Okay, anyway, I'm just if you can get by with it, okay. But then suddenly he began to realize what had happened, that he himself had been used. He had been co-opted by Richard Nixon, and if you'll notice, he hasn't been, as far as we know, at least it hasn't been announced under Ford or under Carter or under Reagan, he hasn't been in the White House since. So he has had to come to terms with how do you, as a sort of a person interested in Christianizing America, show your patriotism. He has changed that also. I've got a time in, it was 1970, right at the height of all the trouble after the hippies and the burnings and all the difficulties. There was a rally staged, guess what, by Walt Disney at the Washington, Monument about the love America, and the sermon about, the good Christian is the one who waves the flag, who supports his country, and who does what's right, thinking in that way that through goodwill, through virtue, through good intentions, we could purge some of the difficulties that were facing the body politic at that particular time. And so with private property and with his patriotism, he's accepted pretty much the status quo as somebody who is trying to balance this back and forth. And it has only been, and I'll stop with this because I'd like to get your comments on this. It's only been in the last 5 or 6 years that he's made a significant break with his earlier position, especially now coming out in a very courageous and laudatory fashion for arms control, for the nuclear freeze. He'll even have, for instance, never would have happened 8 years ago, having his own articles published in Sojourners magazine. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to have a demonstration of how far you've gone, you have to look on that, because before, at best, it would have been in Reader's Digest, and now he's in in Sojourners, and for that I laud him, because he's been willing to see where he had made some mistakes before and is trying, as so many of the rest of us are, to find some balance, as you were talking about, between the fundamentalists on one hand and the humanists on the other. So I think he's a very good case study. The only problem with him, it's the way, like we were talking about with Moon yesterday, the only problem is that this often happens with a really great leader, a charismatic leader like this. Maybe there isn't the opportunity to prepare for a successor. I mean, Graham can pull it off because people have learned to respect Billy Graham. That's why, people said, isn't it sort of egocentric to name your program the Billy Graham program? Shouldn't you give it some religious kind of name? And he said, no, because people are so afraid, rightly so, of all the shysters and charlatans and ripoff artists in the religion, that they have to know that they want to know that their money is going to a specific individual, and they it won't be misused as the way it would with many of the others. And so it's centered around the person of Billy Graham himself. And if that works, if that lasts, with somebody like his brother-in-law, Leighton Ford, fine. But right now it's rather dubious. But I think that would be my sort of case study of what Walt was laying out for us. Yeah, thank you.
We've got 2 hours and 15 minutes of... that clock says 9:25, but that's sure it's wrong.
I think that's Honolulu time, isn't it?
Oh. I wanted to add, there's an excellent biography of Billy Graham.
Marshall Frady.
By Marshall Frady, we've wanted to have all our seminarians read, but I think it's out of print, or at least the hardcover is out. I hope it's out in paper.
I recommend this too. I didn't have a blackboard here. Marshall Frady, F-R-A-D-Y, himself a Southern Baptist clergy, right, and a journalist. And there are others too. John Pollock has the authorized biography. But I'm always suspicious, no matter what biography it is, when you see the authorized biography, because that means the person you're writing about has authorized it. And so it's probably sanitized.
But
Marshall Frady, excellent. Little Brown, a very good biography.
Last comment. I think the president with whom he had the most to do was Lyndon Johnson, who was summoned by Johnson or Johnson's staff every time Johnson got depressed. And Graham would always come and assure him, no, he was doing the right thing, and he was on God's side, and God was certainly on his. And Graham would spend days in the White House just comforting and encouraging Johnson. I think one of the things that has happened, and in this respect there may not be a successor to Graham, is the appalling discovery after Watergate of the dreadful risk of identifying religion with public policy. And I think presidents want that. I think they really do. I think almost anybody in power wants to have policies blessed by God. That's why they invoke God so much. But I think prominent religious figures, if they have any sense at all, and Graham certainly does, and he's really, the respect for him, I think, is deserved. Public religious figures have learned that in our particular society, it is very dangerous for religion to identify itself with public policies. But you see, that gives us our dilemma. See, and Graham is the example of that, of what happens when you do, and then where do you have to go when you don't.
Right. And the danger, you know, of identifying our position with the will of God. Somebody was at Time Magazine pointed out that in his State of the Union speech in January, President Reagan said we have to be careful about our identifying, you know, the American way with God's way, and then in the next 45 minutes he did it 11 times.
Mm-hmm.
So a hand over here.
Now.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the grand article on Sojourners. I commend Sojourners, I think, for being courageous enough to do that, because they've been for so long identified with a rather limited kind of constituency.
Yeah.
I think a good one, but nevertheless an unpopular one.
Yeah.
But I still wonder, and I'm terribly suspicious of Graham and others like that, who jump onto the bandwagon, as it were, that late in the game, and are now parroting the kind of words and slogans and movements that have been current for 10 years.
Yeah.
You see, I guess I have to really question, in my own mind, Graham's conversion, as it were,
mm-hmm.
you know, from one cultural position to something else. And I have real serious doubts about that integrity. And I wonder if you.
Sure.
Who perhaps have more depth on that could enlighten me.
Well, I don't know about enlightenment. Well, to clear that up, what the enlightenment was. But seriously, you know, it depends on if you're more cynical than you are optimistic, and you know your basic sort of attitude towards life itself. And any movement like the Freeze movement, I think, would be glad for anybody who comes along, even if they're Johnny Come Latelys or Billy Come Latelys, in this case. And I myself. Would tend to be less critical, because Graham knows how every word can be used and how every word is scrutinized by him. That's one problem Jesse Jackson, we were talking about that the other day, never realized about his Jaime and Jaimetown remarks. He never realized how the press would take those up and become unrelenting in their pressure on him until it actually came out. I mean, the press wasn't giving him much attention at all until that happened. The same thing, I think Graham over the years has become so sensitized to how the press will react that if it looks like it's insincere or expedient or something else like that, he would be nailed by the press. I mean, the press, it's like with Carter especially, and now with Reagan so much too, they're simply waiting, they've got landmines for public celebrities to make mistakes or to trip on and look foolish about. Who was it saying about, Dan, about important people slipping on a banana? And so I'm convinced that Graham has thought about this a great deal and is willing to do this, because otherwise you get in, as it happened, John F. Kennedy in 1960, as an example. He kept up, there were five, it was Humphrey and Johnson, and there were two other people who ran for the presidency in the Democratic ticket in 1960. And Kennedy had one of his Irish mafia keeping a list of all the important people who were for him before the primaries. In other words, a loyalty test. And you got buttons. I was for JFK before. This sort of thing. And I think you can say that some people should have been for the Freeze, arms control and all this before this time. It's the same thing you could say for Vietnam. Remember how Humphrey was crucified because he wasn't on the bandwagon fast enough. And Mondale, McGovern, so on. And I would be very reluctant to have a time frame be the judge as to the sincerity of a person.
I think that two things need to be said. First of all, Graham, most of his life was a consensus religious figure. And he knows when he steps into the nuclear issue, he can no longer be a consensus figure. So he's giving up, in a sense, something that he's been living out through most of his life. I think the second thing is that all of us read the Bible, in a sense, with certain spectacles on, which block out some things, but Graham, at least, always has said he takes the Bible seriously. And I think what finally happened was somebody persuaded him there were more passages in the Bible besides believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved in your house, which was just about his whole canon for a long time. And I think the value of something like Sojourners is that they too take the Bible with great seriousness, but a bit more of it than Graham had, and finally got to him on his terms. So I think it's a genuine thing.
Yeah, let's hand here.
Is it possible that a person's positions, such as Graham's on a political issue, could be right today and wrong 10 years from now?
I thought about this a long time because I said some complimentary things about Graham, but I've become somewhat suspicious, and one reason I'm not in that evangelical fundamentalist camp is I've heard ministers stand up and say, the Bible says, and 10 years later, the Bible is saying something else. At what point can you be sure that that's what the Bible says? And I imagine that'll irk some people here and rattle some teacups, but, that's all right. I've got some real problems, with that particular one, but I think sometimes the flow of world events, new discoveries, technology, all the rest of these things simply force sort of things to happen. The whole thing with, the crisis with world starvation and all the rest of these things, this wasn't an issue before. The population crisis, I've been reading, there's a very good series in the Christian Century Monitor right now, and of course right now today, isn't it, the big population conference is starting in Mexico City? I think it's today, and those weren't issues before, and we didn't have, a great deal of, good theological insight. So I would suspect that if you look at it in that sense, that we learn more and some things become issues more quickly than others, I think that in that sense, sure. Yeah.
You talked a little bit earlier, or at the beginning there in your introduction, you talked about the relationship of the church to a society that is basically founded on enlightened principles and the way in which those two complement each other and the way in which that there is a tension that existed between reason and revelation. I'm wondering if in these last, I don't know if postmodern is the correct term for some of this thinking or not, but I guess people like Harry Commoner and Alvin Toffler and a number of these, I guess what I would at least call postmodern thinkers, are seriously calling into question how reliable reason itself is. It's sometimes that all it succeeds in doing is digging a deeper hole for us. It turns out to be our nemesis rather than our salvation. I'm wondering what sort of impact, and maybe I even saw some of that same stuff happening with Billy Graham, which you were talking about, I don't know. But I'm wondering how that has affected, if at all yet, the relationship between the church and society, or between that tension that you were talking about between reason and revelation. It would seem to me that it would enhance the church's proclamation of revelation.
Yeah, I want to say, first of all, we are certainly, I think, somewhat chastened in our larger cultural commitments. You were talking about the fact that, I think somewhere along the line, that Watergate provided us with a kind of watershed experience in American history, which made us really question ourselves and maybe question the larger cultural commitments that we have made.
Robert McNamara came to the White House in 1960 with a kind of unflagging commitment in American know-how, can-do, optimism, technology, scientific reason, and left the White House in 1967, or left the administration in 67, just chastened and shattered in many ways because he discovered limitations. I know when you talked about that, you talked about that in connection with Reagan.
Right.
And Reagan is in many ways the tub thumper for pre-Watergate Enlightenment America. Although I think with less reason than most people, you just have to ignore vast swatches of human experience to do that. Now I think what you're illustrating is some disenchantment with the whole Enlightenment culture. We've learned, for example, that nature is a far more complex phenomenon than the Enlightenment thinkers thought. We have learned that there are limitations. We have learned that our political institutions have changed radically. We have come to expect of our representatives in Congress and legislature now that they do indeed simply take opinion polls and represent at least enough of a majority in a district to get reelected, which has thrown the whole notion of a Congress into some sort of chaos and made us wonder again what has happened. But that in its own way has been a critique of the Enlightenment notion. So that's happened. I think you're pointing to your fingers to that. Now the problem is, for me at least, that the church has not been the one raising these issues, or I should say the theologians or the churches, a few have. Reinhold Niebuhr is probably the person who exemplifies a lot of what I've been talking about. But rarely have theologians been looked to for the articulation of this. Instead, we've gone to writers of pop culture like Toffler. They're the ones who are, I think, calling attention to some of the problems. And what this, again, well, I don't know what this means for the churches. Does this mean we will, in a sense, jump on a new movement and then try to say, see, we were right all along? We can hardly do that. We have allowed ourselves at times to be co-opted. Graham is an example of that. Then at times we've been sort of dropouts, back to sort of private religion. It's been very difficult for us to find a role in American society that is both relevant and faithful. And that's been our problem, right, Ron?
Yeah, a little over a year ago, we had Graham on the Pacific Lutheran University campus when he was doing filming for his recent film, The Prodigal. And several of us hosted him at a luncheon. We asked him several questions, coming back to the distinction between nurture and nature. He seemed to be saying things to support the notion that much of Christianity, as he perceives it now, is in fact nurture. He talked about gestation periods. He talked about this kind of thing. I attended, for the second time in my life, a Graham crusade in Tacoma. I heard one 25 years ago, and I heard language like this being used, which surprised me a little bit. He also had a son who was a student of ours for a little while, suggesting that there may be some affirmation of the tradition which would support nurture as well.
Right, yeah. I'm personally delighted. Yeah, I want to get some more in here, sure.
I'm just intrigued with the comparison between Greg Nominer and Billy Graham. I sense that one represents theology and the other one rational thoughts almost the same degree, very minimal. And were leaders of movements that had to be simplified to the point of almost disappearing in order to be understood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's an intriguing comparison.
That simply comes out of our commitment to democracy, small d democracy, that every person is the equal of everybody, every other person, and that there shouldn't be a hierarchy, right? I think we have one more.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit more time. Okay. In relation to Martin King representing the critique
Graham grew in that particular experience because the first time he preached in the South after he became famous, he faced a segregated audience. The first time, I forget which southern city it was in. At first, when he heard about it, he hadn't been asked about seating arrangements beforehand. You usually work, you know, through your local council of churches and things, and he hadn't been asked. And at first he said no, he didn't even want to go out, but then everything and the arrangements had all been done. And then, starting in the early 60s, he stood for a gradual evolutionary improvement in civil rights things, but took a great deal of heat, and then later on, when it was over, said that much of the heat on him was deserved. But he had a different attitude about what the role of the church should be. Of course, Graham, on the other hand, is, and he admits it, that he has almost a luxurious position because he says his is a very specialized ministry. His is simply that of mass revivalism, and he doesn't act as though his ministry is that of a, quote, church. He is to bring them to the church, and then, you know, with your pledge, not your pledge cards, but your cards, then it's to take it from there. And he says he doesn't pretend to present an entire balanced ministry in that sense. So by contrast to King on that, sure, it's a good question.
There, please.
Sure, Kevin.
Does, do you see King as being, in our current, more modern time, the one major media force that presents an alternative to the Enlightenment, right, the critiquing of the Enlightenment? You know, I guess I'm seeing him representing people worldwide now. Representing
King.
A way of seeing things that meant, would that be a critique of the Enlightenment?
That's a very interesting question. King studied under liberal theologians in Boston. And I'm using liberal here again in a purely descriptive sense. American liberal Protestantism bought into a lot of the values of the Enlightenment and was hardly critical of them at all. Simply said, yeah, that's Christianity. King got his education under that, but then was also a Baptist, with a tension to the scriptures. And it seems to me that one can hardly be attentive to the scriptures without eventually being forced to ask some questions. But again, it's interesting to listen to King's, or to read King's speeches and to read his books. You don't find very much of the traditional Baptist language, sin and redemption. You find other themes, other motifs. I find them compatible, but I don't find him engaging in a kind of critique of the larger Enlightenment culture. I think his final hope would be that blacks too would have a piece of the American pie.
This and the first really connected up to the Vietnam War with the civil rights movement, and that's when he got really, the FBI started working like crazy on him. I mean, he started critiquing really powerfully that kind of thing. All right, got along with the civil rights, but when he hit the Vietnam War, then he was packing away.
Yeah, the question, though, is not critique of the war or even critique of anything. I think the question is whether one can engage in a critique of the whole underlying assumptions of a culture, assumptions so much embedded in our outlook that we're not even aware of them. It's almost the unexamined, the unchallengeable. And I do not hear King going after those larger cultural assumptions. Policies, yes, but not the larger cultural assumptions. And I think the kind of thing that I was suggesting here when I talked about the church as conspirator would be, first of all, someone who breathes the environment with the Enlightenment. We all do that. I mean, I live in this culture. But someone who at the same time is forced on other grounds to raise questions about the fundamental values of that culture. Makes me very insecure when I have to do that, and I'm not sure I'm always understood when I do that. Like, when I talk about the difference between hope and optimism, eyes glaze over, and people say, that's what theologians argue about. But see, there is a real difference, And so I'm either not understood, or if I am, I'm going to be run out on a rail. So I, you know, I would preach sermons sometimes hoping that people wouldn't understand me. And I largely succeeded. But that's what's at stake, you see. And that's a very difficult thing for us to get at. I don't think King did that.
One more.
There.
I'm wondering if your model of conspirator both agreeing with and fighting against, what shape that might take for us as Lutherans in the rest of this decade, in the rest of the 80s? How might that appear?
Let me give you one quick answer. The book is just out, one which I'm sure many of us will disagree, but he is a Lutheran and a reflective Lutheran. Richard John Newhouse has a new book out, The Naked Public Square, in which he lays out something of a quasi-Lutheran agenda on that particular one. Yeah.
Come tomorrow at 10:45. No, I'm serious, because that's really the subject matter of what I want to talk about then tomorrow.
And you can't make a better transition for lunch than that.
I think so, yeah. But that's, you put your finger right on it, and am I glad.